This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Putin has created the thing that he fears, which is he's personally turned the Ukrainian people against Russia and against him personally.
War has suddenly returned to Europe. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has been swift, shocking, and devastating. In addition to killing thousands of civilians and soldiers, the incursion has rocked global financial markets and galvanized the West against Russia in ways not seen since the Cold War. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk to Russian foreign policy expert Ann Clunin to learn more about this unilateral act of military aggression. We examine Vladimir Putin's possible motivations in invading a sovereign nation like Ukraine, look at the ways the war will affect energy markets, and talk about how Russia's massive nuclear arsenal may influence diplomatic and military strategy. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Ann Clunin. Ann is a Russian foreign policy expert, an associate professor at the Naval Postgraduate School at Monterey, California, and a faculty affiliate at the Center for Security and International Cooperation at Stanford University. Ann, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm very fortunate to have Russian foreign policy expert friends like you at a time like this. We are in very crazy times. As we've seen the Ukrainian people fight back, most of the reports have that Vladimir Putin has overplayed his hand, did not expect this kind of resistance, had bad intelligence, thought that this would be kind of a cakewalk. Is that accurate?
First, I just need to say that the views that I express here are my own views and not those of the Department of Defense or the Department of the Navy or the Naval Postgraduate School. I think it's safe to say that Vladimir Putin badly miscalculated the war in Ukraine. He has surrounded himself with just a few individuals, and that has formed an echo chamber where they sort of repeat to him the things he wants to hear. And so he did not understand that the main result of his annexation of Crimea and invasion of Donbass in 2014 has created a lot of animosity amongst the Ukrainian population towards the Russian government, animosity that wasn't there prior to their aggression in 2014. And so they had believed that they would be greeted by a number of, you know, Russian-speaking Ukrainians who would welcome the Russian army in. And as a result, they thought that they would be able to quickly take the capital and achieve their goal of capturing the government and installing a puppet government of their own. And that has clearly failed.
Now, no one can think that the Russian military can't, quote-unquote, take Ukraine. But there's much more to it than that. Like, once you've occupied this country, the rest of the world has really reacted to this invasion in a profoundly unified way. Yes, we haven't seen India or China, the two most populous nations on earth, take a strong stand yet. But we're seeing countries like Sweden and Switzerland, famously neutral, freeze Russian assets. Unfortunately, the sanctions are going to be hitting the most vulnerable populations in Russia right away. But ultimately, do you think that these sanctions can have a lasting effect on Putin's reign, possibly leading to him being unseated?
It's an excellent question. And one of the things that we don't know and that Russia watchers have been discussing is how strong he is internally. He has been pursuing a strategy where he sort of rotates the same group of people through government positions with different perks and sort of money associated with them. But in doing this action, he is severely damaging the Russian economy, and that has cut off access to the money that has kept his supporters supporting him. And so we should expect to see more defections, really, from him, and more discussion of what comes after Putin. That said, it's going to take a while. This is not going to be something that happens overnight. It would likely take years. The Russian economy is already feeling the consequences of this. Russians are going to face hyperinflation because the Bank of Russia is now isolated from SWIFT and cut off from taking advantage of the large amount of international reserves that the Russian government has put away. And so there's nowhere to spend the money because they can't do transactions with banks overseas. And that means that it's going to be very difficult for them to defend the value of the ruble. It's already fallen over 40% of its value. And so life in Russia is going to become much harder for the Russian population.
And can you put Russia's position as a global leader in terms of natural gas and oil production into context for us, Anne?
For energy, you know, Russia, prior to U.S. fracking, was the number one supplier of gas overseas. And one of the things that the Obama administration did, as you know, much to the ire of environmentalists, was to support fracking in part to challenge Russia's energy weapon, if you will. And Russia really has weaponized the sale of gas. And that was a calculated choice by the Obama administration, that it was more important to ensure that the U.S. could counter Russia, not only for U.S. energy security, but also for European energy security. The most important thing that we need to understand about what's happened with Russia's weaponization of energy is that it has galvanized the Europeans to start taking seriously their own energy security. And this started in 2006 when Russia first turned off the gas to Ukraine, and then sort of intensified after 2009 when it did it again. But of course, today what we're seeing is, you know, a complete about face by the Germans. And the Germans have long been the main advocate for maintaining a commercial relationship with the Russians in the energy sector, so much so that the former chancellor of Germany, Gerhard Schröder from the Social Democratic Party, sits on the board of Gazprom and was one of the major forces behind the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that has now been suspended by the current Social Democratic Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz.
And we just saw BP break ties with Gazprom, and I think Shell also. What does that mean?
What it means is that these companies are deprived of Western foreign investment, and they are deprived of Western technology. For some of these companies, reinvestment by European and American energy companies is necessary so that they have the technology to create the drilling rigs, for example, off the Kamchatka coast, because in those kinds of conditions, you have, you know, lots of ice, very rough seas, and very deep wells that need to be drilled. And they were reliant on BP's technology and Shell's technology for that. So this matters because, of course, now Russia is looking north to the Arctic, and it will need that kind of technology in the Arctic conditions if it's to go forward. And so the main effect that these sanctions are going to have is on basically turning Russia into a technologically obsolete energy producer, as well as technologically obsolete in terms of its domestic technology industries and things like that.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Russian foreign policy expert Anne Clunin. So Anne, I watched a show, I can't remember the name of it, on Netflix it was a Norwegian show and had a fairly
Borgen.
Vanilla name. No, not Borgen. I like that. That was Danish. This was a Norwegian show where the Russians take over Norway based on the Norwegian oil supplies. And they're like, you know what? We're just taking over. We like it. And the rest of the European countries just were like, hey, Norway, we'd like to help you out, but sorry, we need Russian oil and we're just going to lay it low on this. And it seemed fairly implausible. But compared to the reasons that Russia went into Ukraine, it seems much more likely. I mean, I talked to a common friend of ours from high school who lived in Russia a long time and speaks the language and asked him what was Putin thinking going in there strategically. And he couldn't give me a real straight answer except that it's much more historical and much more emotional. Is that an accurate assessment in your view?
It is. There's a lot of discussion right now about who's to blame for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And one of the popular memes that we've heard in the United States that it's our fault for expanding NATO up to Russia's borders. And that's just fundamentally not true. What has happened is that Vladimir Putin, as a decision maker, has fundamentally changed since 2006. And his worldview has increasingly become anti-Western, xenophobic, and nationalistic. And the Russian perspective on Ukraine and on Belarus is that these are Russians who just happen to live outside of Russia, and that they are all one ethnic group. The Russian leadership will refer to Ukrainians as Little Russians, which is not particularly popular in Ukraine. The origins of, sort of the Russian nation as well as the Ukrainian nation lie in Ukraine today. And the way the Russians view this is that, the parts of Ukraine that are outside of Russia, or I shouldn't say the Russians view this, but Vladimir Putin views this, is he's come to believe this very far right ideology put forth by folks like Dugin and Gumilyov, which sort of look at the ethnic Russians as, people that fill the three Slavic republics, a couple of places in the Baltics, and that need to be reunited. And this far-right perspective was beyond the pale under the Yeltsin administration and under the first three terms of the Putin and then the Medvedev presidential terms. And it's only since he was reelected in 2012 that he has really made this much more mainstream. There is official government funding for the Russian World Foundation abroad. There are repeated, media appearances by Dugin on Russian state channels. And the whole narrative has been sort of talking about Ukraine as part of what Putin calls Novaya Russia or Ruski Mir, so New Russia or the Russian world. And there's a distinction your listeners might not understand, but in the Russian language, there's a way of describing ethnic Russians to distinguish them from Russian citizens. And ethnic Russians are Ruskiye, and Russian citizens who may be of different ethnicities are Rossiyanin. And so Putin very carefully has been sticking to the civic term Rossiyanin, but increasingly in his language and what we've been hearing coming out of him recently, he's increasingly using the ethnic modifier, saying that, that Ukrainians in Ukraine who are, allegedly being killed by the Ukrainian neo-fascists, which is nonsense, are in fact ethnic Russians. And they may be, in fact, ethnic Russians, but they have not identified with Russia since 2014, right? Putin has created the thing that he fears, which is he's personally turned the Ukrainian people against Russia and against him personally.
Life, keep me free from birth, give me hope.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to Russian foreign policy expert Ann Clunin. You're talking about the language that he's using. How effective are his propaganda methods in a new world, a new connected world? This is not 1979 when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. There's not three stations on TV anymore, right?
Television is almost essentially entirely owned by the state. So all of the channels that are on television are state-owned channels, or they are owned by oligarchs who are allowed to own them on the condition that they sort of parrot the state line, right? That audience for media tends to be the, you know, 40 and over crowd. And so anyone who's watching television is getting a completely different version of reality than we are. Russians do not see what we see. And on the other hand, those who get their information from social media, the internet, and from newspapers and radio and newsprint are still, there is still a little bit of freedom in Russia. And I've been very heartened to see that newspapers that had sort of fallen under self-censorship have now come out against the war. So there is dissensus in society, but by and large, what has happened on the TV channels is that the Russian government is saying that they're only doing an operation in the Donbas, that they're not doing any operations outside of the Donbas. So most Russians don't think that there is a war going on, and they have to dig a little bit deeper. Now, what's, of course, changing that is that there are lots of Russians outside of Russia and lots of Ukrainians outside of Russia who have relatives in Russia who are using their own personal contacts to get the message across. So the longer the war goes on, the more likely we're going to see increased public outrage at what Putin has done, because Russians feel about Ukrainians the way Americans feel about Canadians.
So there's not this deep-seated animosity between the countries.
No, Russians and Ukrainians love one another. And the competition, again, is over hockey. It's not over, you know, who controls Kiev. So this is just, it's sort of unfathomable for Russians that their government would attack Ukraine. And that is why Putin has been so careful to try to stage manage this and manufacture this as a Ukrainian provocation. Right. And that is one of the reasons why both the Ukrainian government and the West was so careful not to give him any pretext for saying that the Russians were pushed into invading.
From a military standpoint, we've seen Putin remind the world that he has nuclear capabilities that are incredibly potent. And the declaration he made of it was actually not part of their doctrine. And so it really didn't have any teeth in terms of, it wasn't like a DEFCON 4 or something like that. It was more like a reminder to the West that, hey, don't resist me too much because I have this as my ace card. Is there any possibility in your mind that he uses it if things should get more desperate for him?
I hope not. So there are a couple of facets to Russia's nuclear posture. The first thing that your guests should know is that Russia has long said that it would use what it calls a limited or tactical nuclear response to conventional military threats to what it views as its national interests. And for a long time, their military doctrine has identified NATO as and the United States as the primary enemies of Russia. Russia also has a nuclear posture that is, or a strategy that is called escalate to de-escalate, the notion being that they would use such a limited nuclear strike in order to increase the pain on the adversary and then force them to the bargaining table and start de-escalating from there, which is a very scary strategy, right? It sort of goes against the Cold War thinking about mutual assured destruction and never getting to the nuclear threshold and using nuclear weapons.
When did this new doctrine emerge?
I think 2008 is when we first started seeing it. And then the strategy has really taken shape after 2012. The backdrop to this is that Russia has undergone a 10-year modernization of its military, including its nuclear forces. So it's been building new warheads and building new missiles. And the effort here was to make up for some of the dismal failings of the Russian military in the 1990s in Chechnya, but also some of the failings that they saw in 2008 in the war against Georgia. And they've largely succeeded. And so getting back to the question about the nuclear position now, one of the things that Putin has reiterated, I think now four times with respect to the West, is that, you know, nuclear weapons would be used if anyone did anything to intervene in Ukraine. And there are two sides of this. What we've been focused on have been the economic sanctions that have been taken by the West and that are going to be crushing for the Russian economy. But the thing that is getting less attention is that the West is also supplying lethal military aid to Ukraine. And for the first time ever, the European Union is sending military equipment, including fighter jets, to Ukraine. And that is intervention in a military conflict with Russia. And so Russia has not, in fact, followed up on it, that threat. One has to wonder, you know, if it were to target the, quote, European Union, what would they hit? I want to talk a bit about the conventional front. We're still in the early days yet. And while the Ukrainian military and Ukrainian people have been fighting incredibly heroically against the Russians are not bringing their A game to this. And that is because Putin cannot win the battle at home in selling this war to the public if he's seen to be dropping heavy artillery and bombs on ancient Ukrainian cities and population centers. And so while they have been deliberately targeting civilians, including kindergartens, right, and daycare centers and children's hospitals, that is not getting through into Russia. It's only being seen on the Russian internet. And so we're starting to see people who've used the internet to come out and protest against this, right? So that is heartening. We've seen it with, you know, the sort of artistic community in Russia as well. But depending on how uncertain Putin feels about his ability to hold on to power at home, he could either double down and really start committing mass atrocities, because what we've seen in Ukraine is nothing compared to what the Russians did in Syria. And that could easily happen, but it's very hard to sell that domestically. Dropping cluster munitions, for example, on population centers. And this is part of the miscalculation. The decisive thing that I thought was going to happen if he was serious about this was that they would use just massive amounts of air power to basically establish a no-fly zone over Ukraine. But the Russian Air Force has been largely absent up until now. Now, one of the changes that has come about, and this relates to the nuclear doctrine, is that they have said that they will use tactical nuclear weapons in the conflict with Ukraine, and that one of the things that that puts on the table are these dual-use missile systems, the Kinzhal, and the other hypersonic weapons, that the, you know, super weapons that people have been talking about. Increasingly, since 2007, there are concerns about whether he is fully compos mentis and whether he is actually sort of looking at the situation with what we would consider, you know, a sort of rational perspective. There's been much discussion about his paranoia over COVID. You see him sitting at these ridiculously long tables. You know, if he meets with someone in his cabinet, they have to isolate themselves for 10 days, or they have to go through this disinfectant, you know, shower in order to see him. And so there are real concerns that, you know, his paranoia is affecting his judgment. And that, to me, also speaks to what's going to happen at home. The thing that Putin fears the most is a color revolution in Russia.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Russian foreign policy expert Anne Clunin. She's the author of The Social Construction of Russia's Resurgence. What kind of safeguards does Putin have to protect himself? how do you see it playing out in a possible revolutionary type scenario?
So in addition to the military modernization that Putin ordered over the past 10 years, that has been overshown by the modernization of the internal security services. And so really the ability to create a surveillance state, everything from the tax man who has, can see 100% of what Russians buy and sell, to changing the laws to make it increasingly difficult for people to express dissent, either through freedom of assembly or through freedom of speech. For example, with the protests starting in 2011 that lasted through 2013, after Putin announced he was going to run for president again, they changed the laws on assembly such that, if you brought someone who was a minor to a protest, then you were endangering that minor and you could be imprisoned for it, right? Changing the definition of treason to make it include these kinds of situations. So holding these big sticks over the heads of non-governmental organizations and civil society organizations and media organizations in Russia has been very successful. So civil society is essentially pretty controlled. Most of the protest potential in Russia has recently been about economics. And the more the economic situation goes south, the more likely we are to see that. You combine it with an unpopular war that is hurting the economy and also just seems unthinkable to Russians that they're attacking, their relatives. It creates the potential for a lot of protest. So we should expect tons of censorship now. But as we've seen, we've already seen pretty brutal repression of the protesting that's been going on in Russia itself. And that has already led to 6,000 people being detained. The official government reports say that it's 400 people, but the non-governmental sources say it's much, much larger. So I expect that those detention policies will continue and they will try to keep a very tight lid on this. It could go so far as trying to impose a more sort of paramilitary or martial law kind of situation, depending on how fragile he feels. So I think that, the possibility for a revolution, it's going to take some time, but that's the great fear he has. And he will put everything into preventing that happening. And I don't think he will be afraid to shed Russian blood.
Russian foreign policy expert Anne Clunin. Anne, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome, Alex. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by John Coltrane and George Harrison.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.